Chapter 8. First Among Equals. A man chooses his friends. Fate chooses his brothers. Attributed to Ondrin of Saramanth. The ship came out of the darkness, and within its darkness an endless hunt played out. It was a human ship, an imperial ship, a battleship, a flagship, but it was unnaturally propelled through the miasma of the warp by means whose origins and nature would have been deemed heretical to the machine-smiths and forge-fathers of mankind. Behind the battleship, following in its wake, came its fleet. Within those storm-battered hulls, 20,000 warriors awaited word of a destination, a safe haven. They were 20,000 of the greatest warriors in the Imperium. They were the first, and the first among equals. The ship came out of the darkness, and within its darkness an endless hunt played out. The huntsman waited in the darkness, listening to the eerie throb of the unhuman device directing the ship's engines. The darkness was oily black as the armor he wore. The quarry was close, but then the quarry was always close. The quarry was supposed to be dead, or at the very least a prisoner, but through his innate guile and wickedness he had evaded capture and was loose in the ship, haunting its dark spaces and inaccessible extremities. Of course, the quarry was technically a prisoner, because the whole ship was his cell. There was no escape from the ship. It galled the huntsman that the quarry was at liberty at all. The quarry should have been dead for his crimes long since. The huntsman should have made sure of that, blood or no blood. The quarry was not a sentient being deserving of any respect or mercy. The quarry was an insane animal that needed to be put down, a monster that deserved termination. All the while the wretched quarry was loose on the huntsman's ship, the huntsman's heart burned with rage. The huntsman had sent warriors to locate the quarry and kill him, to section the ship, deck by deck, to smoke the monster out of hiding and end his curse. But the quarry, the creature of darkness, the haunter of the eternal night that glowered in the unlit hold spaces and hull structures that were a feature of any warp-capable ship, had killed the men, and killed the men sent after them, and the men sent after them. The quarry had trapped them and murdered them, stalked them and tricked them, left their bodies swinging from hold spars as warnings, left their heads in void locks as messages, left their butchered remains impaled on interdeck stanchions and pipework as bloody promises. The huntsman was a noble soul, though to those who met him in battle he often appeared to be a monster too. Few, if any, knew the true workings of his mind. He kept his own counsel and walked his own path. He was hard to know. He was a noble soul, nevertheless. He refused to send any more men into the darkness to their deaths. He refused to order any more men to do what he was not prepared to do. He had had all but the primary decks evacuated and sealed. Then he had put on his armour, the black armour etched with Martian gold, and had become the hunter. Every day, for 16 weeks, he had entered the unregulated spaces of his ship and hunted through the darkness for his quarry. Every day, for 16 weeks. The ship came out of the darkness, and within its darkness an endless hunt played out. The huntsman could smell the quarry. They had come close many times in the past 16 weeks. There had been 2 brief scuffles from which the quarry had fled when he had realized that the huntsman was hard to ambush. There had been times when the quarry's brittle whisper of a voice had gusted out of the darkness to taunt the huntsman. There had been messages left in blood. There had been traps and counter-traps, hours of stalking, slow progress through the dark and juddering spaces of the ship, testing every shadow for the one shadow that wasn't a shadow at all. The huntsman halted, crouched, balancing his dense but agile form on a crossbar that ran like a rock bridge over the ravine of an exhaust shaft. A dark green blackness glowed far below. Thermal vents opened and a stream of hot air blew up the shaft like a desert wind. It stirred the huntsman's long golden hair. He paused, unclasped it, regathered it and tied it again to keep it out of his eyes. There was a scent on the dry wind, one part in a billion, but the huntsman could smell it. Old blood, pain, adrenaline, hatred. The quarry was close. He was hiding below on one of the sub-level walkways that lined the throat of the exhaust shaft. In 16 weeks, the huntsman had never got such a precise fix. The hot air was venting from below, and the huntsman was downwind of the quarry. Doubtless the quarry couldn't hear him because of the machine noise echoing up the shaft space. Silently, the huntsman rose and leapt. He landed 20 meters away on another crossbar and ran along it like a tightrope walker before clambering into the girderwork reinforcing the shaft wall. He descended. Every few meters he stopped and scanned, hunting with his eyes, his ears, his sense of smell. Close, so close. There, the huntsman froze. He could see the quarry. He could see him for the first time. The quarry was hunched on a gantry about 30 meters below the huntsman's position. He looked like a ragged hawk roosting on a ledge. The quarry was looking down. For some reason, he was expecting the huntsman to approach from below. For once, his uncanny powers of augury and foresight had failed him. The quarry was waiting, hunched, silent, ready to strike. The quarry had no idea the huntsman was above him. The huntsman drew his sword, oil damp and silent, from his scabbard. He lined up to make the leap. Less a leap, in fact more a pounce. It would be an impact kill. The huntsman's weight and momentum would crush the quarry into the unyielding gantry, and the sword's edge would finish it. It would be quick, which was more than the quarry deserved, but long overdue. The huntsman flexed his arms, loosened his neck, and made ready for the leap. There was no room for error. The quarry was not a creature to underestimate. The huntsman leaned forward, holding onto a girder with his left hand for support, tensing his legs, ready to... My lord! His vox system woke up and crackled. Below, the quarry looked up, his head snapping upright at the sound. The huntsman saw the quarry's pale face, surprise and delight. Close! The quarry squealed up at the huntsman. So close, but confounded! The quarry started to laugh. He darted off the gantry and dropped away into the shaft, arms spread, tattered cloak fluttering like ragged wings. He dropped into the darkness of the exhaust pit, leaving his scornful laughter in the hot wind behind him. The huntsman rocked back. He bit down his rage. He activated his voxlink. Speak, he said, his voice low and seismic. And for your sake, make the content worthwhile. My lord, said the vox, there is a light. A light, the huntsman growled. A beacon, my lord. We have detected a strong but unknown navigational beacon. The huntsman hesitated. Have an assault squad waiting at the agreed exit hatch to meet me, he said. I'm coming out. Let's see this beacon. First Master Augustine was waiting for him on a battlement of the Monita Fortress, overlooking the landing fields of the starport. The First Master was accompanied by several of his key subordinates and a number of officers of the city. They had finished delivering their latest reports and were silent. Augustine was gazing up at the light of the Pharos, the new and only star in the turbulent sky. Augustine's suit system registered the approach of another, and he turned to regard Alexis Pollux as he came along the battlement to join them. Augustine was used to being one of the largest beings in any given place, excepting the Avenging Sun. There was something dismaying to him about the Imperial Fist's captain's size. Lord Augustine, Pollock said, with a respectful bow of his head. My apologies that I was prevented from joining you sooner. Augustine acknowledged him. It was suggested to me that you might assist with your expertise, Captain. You have 3 days' worth of security inspections and protocol reviews to catch up on. Again, I must apologize, said Pollux. His war gear had been cleaned and mended, and his damaged arm was strapped across his chest in a juvenet sling. The Master of Ultramar ordered me to heal and make ready for the coming war. I have been 2 days in the grafting suites. Augustine glanced at the repairs to Pollux's arm. Instead of a simple augmetic replacement, the apothecaries had elected to fix a flesh graft grown from seeded organics, vat-cultured. Inside the semi-transparent sleeve of the sling, beneath the layers of nutrient wrap and growth hormone gel, Pollux wore a new hand and arm of living flesh, which had been biotyped to his own. It was still growing, still forming, the new bone still knitting. Flooded with oxygenated blood, the hand was almost crimson. "Will it take?" asked Augustine. "The prognosis is good," said Pollux. "Another 2 days and rejection can be ruled out. I should be serviceable within a week." Augustine nodded. He gestured for one of his aides. "As I said, we've been conducting the review for 3 days. I have had a summary prepared." The aide handed Pollux a data slate. "How fares the Primarch?" Pollux asked. "He," Augustine began, "he fares well, I understand. Given that it has been merely 3 days, he shows remarkable signs of recovery." Pollux didn't do more than quickly scan the data slate. He turned and looked out over the port fields, then eyed the shadows of ships at high anchor far above and the cloud bank shapes of the orbitals. "I don't believe it's a simple matter of protocol reviews," he said. "You haven't even begun to look at the slate," Augustine started to say. "I can study the close detail later. Believe me, First Master, I have been considering McCragg's security all the while the apothecaries worked on my limb. This is a magnificent port facility, but it is not secure." "What?" Pollux looked at Augustine. "I said it is not secure." "Are you trying to anger me, Captain Pollux?" asked Augustine, stepping forward. Pollux noticed that most of the aides and juniors escorting him took a step backwards. They did not want to get caught in the First Master's wrath. "No, Lord," replied Pollux calmly. "I am trying to help. I took very seriously your great Primarch's request."
"Then look before you speak," Augustine spat. "Since the crime that was Kalth, we have fortified the system. The planetary approaches, set guards and defences, launched new platforms and fortified the city, especially the starport areas, and..."
"You have done all of these things," Pollux agreed, "but you have done them all while preserving the original nature of this world and this port. McCragg is a capital world, sir, and this port is its great harbour. McCragg rules an empire of 500 worlds, sir, the realm of Ultramar. It may even come to rule over the Imperium. It has a port that reflects that role, a port built for trade and commerce, a port built to serve the mercantile needs of peace. Yes, you have fortified it, but it is still not secure. It may withstand an assault, but can it filter out the illegal entry of our enemies? I believe it is reasonable to expect that those killers who meant to take the life of your Primarch are not the only intruders currently here on McCragg."
"Is this how your kind would protect Terra?" asked Augustine scornfully. "To cast away all of its original purposes and make it nothing more than a razor-wired rampart?"
Pollux nodded.
"I fully expect that my Primarch will have encased Terra in armour. I fully expect that the Imperial Palace is no longer a palace, but the greatest fortress in the galaxy. This is a war like none we have ever contested, sir. It will make casualties of us all if we do not respect it, or if we are too precious about our possessions."
"So what? We stop trying to fortify and preserve what we have, and instead simply rebuild it?"
"Yes. In times like this, it is not enough to bar or board up a window, my lord. You must brick it shut so that the window no longer exists. The reconstruction work needed on the city, and especially the port, will be costly and time-consuming. You must begin work on the construction of a fortified military port. There are remedial actions that can be made while construction is planned and executed.
Such as? Asked Augustine.
Pollux gestured at the ships at anchor overhead.
Let nothing, and I mean nothing, come within firing distance of Macragg until it has been inspected. I suggest using some of the outer star forts in mid-system as way stations. Let no ship land or send landers to the surface until the identity of both the ship and its occupants have been verified by eye and gene code.
That will slow all trade and imports to a crawl, said one of the city officials.
It will, Pollux agreed, but it will also slow down the ticking of the doomsday clock.
What of our veterans returning from Kalth and the other war zones? Asked an ultramarines captain beside Augustine. Must their passage be delayed in this ignominious way too?
I think after what happened in the residency, grumbled Augustine, we know the answer to that. What else, Pollux?
That, he said, pointing at the orbiting wreck of the furious abyss, now clearly visible as it crested the horizon.
It's dead, said Augustine, and what's left of it is being dismantled by reclamation teams. What of it?
It's a hazard to navigation, Pollux replied, and furthermore, it is a military threat. Effective sabotage could knock it from orbit and drop every megaton of its metal bulk on this city. The enemy is not beyond such tricks, First Master. That corpse ship must be towed beyond the orbit of the outer moons and dismantled there.
Anything else?
Orbit to surface teleporting must be restricted, and all entry to the planet by craft or teleport forbidden, unless it comes through the designated area of this port. I suggest the installation of upgraded void shields to cover the lower orbital tracks and the port area, enough to close it down if necessary. I also suggest a proportion of the orbital sensor systems and AuSpex modules be retasked to cover the surface of the planet.
Why?
I'm talking about a new philosophy of defence, First Master. You have fortified the system, the planet and the city in case of another Kalth. You have more than enough ships and battery systems to fend off any openly hostile approach to Macragg. But the incident in the residency proves that an open assault is not the only way our enemies may come for us. Treachery comes in different scales, sir. A small percentage of your AuSpex modules could be retrained to cover the entire surface of this world without significant impairment of the early warning or system scanning watch processes. If anyone lands a ship or uses a drop pod or a teleport system outside this restricted port area, you'll know about it. Do not assume you can keep them out, sir. A planet is a vast area. Assume they will get in, and make sure you see their footprints when they do.
Augustine pursed his lips. He was annoyed at the way the Imperial Fist had schooled him in basic defence analysis, and made the conclusions look so obvious. But he also knew that including most of Pollux's suggestions in his report would make it look as though he'd done a particularly thorough job.
"You're worth listening to, Pollux," he said grudgingly.
"I take that as high praise from you, sir."
Pollux looked up at the light of the Pharos.
"You have hung up a lamp to draw travellers here out of the storm, my lord, and that is right and just, and the only way that a fair and noble civilization can survive. However, you must scrutinize who and what the light brings to you, and how disguised their real motives are. I would certainly like to know more about your new Astronomicon. Understanding its function and process may assist me in making good recommendations for Macragg's protection. I do not even know where it is situated or what manner of technology allows it to function."
"That is classified," said one of the aides, "but I'm sure the Primarch will permit you to discuss basics with the Warsmith."
"Did you say Warsmith?" asked Pollux.
The aide nodded.
"Warsmith Dantioch has led the operation to activate the Pharos," said Augustine.
"An iron warrior?" Pollux asked, his voice low.
"Is that a problem, Captain?"
Gilliman walked with a slight limp, though it would mend. His throat and one side of his face looked as though he had been dragged along rockcrete by a scimitar jet bike. He had dressed in a loose tunic and robes to cover the extensive bandaging around his torso, and had refused the armoured body glove for reasons of mobility and comfort. He told his advisers that he would not be making a similar error again. However, until he was healed enough to wear full warplate, he accepted the heavy belt slung with a refractor field generator which he wore under his robes. To it he had holstered a Maetherian ray pistol, a formidable piece of archaeotech from his personal collection. Titus Prato and Dracus Gorod of the Invictus accompanied him wherever he went, the librarian and the heavy-armoured beast ready to sense danger and dispense violence. So escorted, he returned to the residency for the first time since the attack. He had ordered that nothing be touched or repaired until he had the chance to review the scene. Titus Prato read very cleanly the psychological intent of this. Gilliman wanted to face his demons. He wanted to look directly at the circumstances in which he had nearly died. Prato could sense the underlying tension in the Primarch like a tremble in the air. It disquieted him. When the greatest beings in the universe registered stress or tension, it was time for all things living to find cover. They came up the hallway. The carpet was dappled with dark stains, a trail of blood where Gorod and his men had carried Gilliman out. Ahead of them was the door that the Invictus guard had cut open. Men waited for them at the doorway, a pack of men. They looked up, yellow eyes alert, heads cocked the moment Gilliman and his escort came into view. They had been huddled around the doorway, resting or sharpening their blades. None of them had dared cross the threshold into the Primarch's inner chambers. Gilliman approached. Fafner Bloodbroder's wolf pack rose to meet him, not as a challenge, but as an honour guard. "This isn't my hearth," Gilliman said, looking at the pack leader.
"No, Jarl, it's your door," Fafner agreed. "Your door will do for now."
Gilliman nodded.
"We were told not to go in, told it was your orders," Fafner added.
"They were my orders," Gilliman agreed.
"Dogs must always wait at the doorpost," Gorod rumbled out of the depths of his Terminator plate, "until the master lets them in. Good dogs, that is, good dogs stay at the edge of the firelight, waiting for scraps until they are allowed near the hearth."
Fafner turned his head slowly and stared into the cataphractor's gargoyle visor. His eyes were unblinking. One of his men leaned forward and whispered something into the pack leader's ear. A half-smile crinkled Fafner's lips, exposing one fang.
"No, Bosoran," he said, "I can't let you do that, though it would be funny to watch."
Fafner glanced up at Gilliman.
"You'd let your warrior speak to me like that, Jarl?" he asked.
"It's exactly what you were thinking," said Titus Prato.
Fafner looked at Prato. He sniffed and then chuckled and nodded.
"It was, Maleficarum, it was. True enough, we have a low opinion of ourselves, I suppose, but a high opinion of our loyalty and obedience." "What about your obedience, Jarl Gilliman?"
Fafner asked sidelong of the avenging son, his stare fixed rigidly on the librarian's face.
"Is it questioned, Wolf?" asked Gilliman. "Because I use the librarius in defiance of the edict. The edict was made before this war was begun. It is obsolete. We need the librarius if we're going to survive. Does that make me disobedient?"
Fafner let out a deep, wet growl, like a jungle beast. His eyes stayed on Prato's face.
"He thinks it might make you courageous and decisive in your obedience," Prato told Gilliman, holding Fafner's stare. "To pursue your loyalty through decisive, unilateral, and perhaps unpopular choices.
He thinks that's why you are a great leader.
Gilliman nodded.
Tell him the rest while you're in there, Maleficarum, said Fafner. He thinks he will, nevertheless, keep a very close watch on you, Lord, said Prato.
A day without a clumsy threat from you is not complete, is it, Fafner? Asked Gilliman. Really, again with this, me alone in a room against a squad of 10, in case you've missed recent events, I've already done that.
Fafner Bloodbroder shrugged.
They were Alpha Legion, not wolves.
I did it unarmed.
Fafner broke his gaze from Prato and looked at Gilliman.
I never said it wasn't well done, he replied.
Prato smiled.
Will you let my pack guard your hall, Jarl? Asked Fafner. We've come a long way to protect the Emperor's peace.
I think that responsibility is fully covered, rumbled Gorod, his words grinding out of the helmvox one by one, like heavy caliber rounds from a chain-fed weapon.
Not well enough, looks like, replied Fafner.
Not even nearly well enough, added Bo Sorin.
You may cross my threshold, wolves, Gilliman said. You may approach the fireside. I'll permit it, but do not obstruct Gorod or his men. Can you be obedient in that respect?
Fafner nodded. His men broke and stood aside. Gilliman entered the room where he had nearly met his end. The furniture was shattered. The great desk was scarred and gouged like a meteor. There were holes in the walls, the floor, the ceiling. Pictures had fallen from their suspensions and broken. One portrait of Conor still hung, but the entire area of the face and shoulders was shot away. Hanging canvas shreds and fibres stilled in the gentle air circulation. All the corpses had been removed, but the carpets were still dyed with the lifeblood of the Legiones Astartes, and the walls were speckled with yet more blood that had dried and looked like black paint or spatters of tar. Parts of the wall and chunks of heavy furniture were peppered with pieces of exploded plate armour, shards of ceramite flung out from exploding wounds to embed like shrapnel. The main windows were crazed with spiderweb patterns. One series of cracks looked like a coiled snake, a multi-headed coiled snake. Gilliman drew a breath. He knew he was in a slightly heightened state. He was reading symbols and portents into things that had no significance. He closed his eyes. For a millisecond, the noise and fury of the moment came back, filling his head every last moment relived in flaring, vivid... He opened his eyes again.
"My lord," asked Prato.
"I'm all right," Gilliman said.
He looked around and moved forward, each step crunching scattered glass chips into the carpet. Conor's cold gestalt cogitator and the stand that had housed it was a smashed wreck on the floor. A falling body had crushed it. Gilliman stared at the debris for a moment. The living history of Macragge, the rise of Ultramar, the fortunes of the 500 worlds had all been witnessed and monitored by that ancient device. It was strange. The loss seemed to carry more emotional weight than had been provoked by the sight of his stepfather's disfigured portrait. Gilliman felt unexpected levels of sentiment rising within him.
"I will need,"
he began. His voice cracked slightly.
"A replacement device," Prato finished quickly. "I will speak to the adepts of the Mechanicum at once about furnishing you with a new cogitator system, a cognisignum application device that will enhance data processing."
Gilliman nodded.
"I feel," he began to say to Prato.
He stopped. Gorod was waiting behind them at the door, the wolves in the doorway behind him. Gilliman walked to the windows on the far side of the room and stood with his back to the doorway, staring out. Prato went with him.
"You feel pain and sadness," said Prato, "and you do not want the others to overhear this."
Gilliman nodded again.
"It is a delayed reaction, Lord," said Prato.
to an attack. I've lived through wars, Prato. I've fought demons and my own brothers. I've taken worse wounds than this.
That was not my meaning, Lord.
Then what? To the loss of an old cogitator?
I think that was just the trigger, my lord. It was an heirloom. It had personal meaning to you.
Then what, I say? A delayed reaction to what?
To Horus, said Prato.
Gilliman sighed deeply.
Make sure they come no closer, he said to Prato.
Prato nodded, letting the unspoken thought finish in his mind.
Because I do not want those wolves to see me with a tear in my damned eyes.
Uten found him alone in the room. Prato had gone to meet with the Mechanicum, and Gilliman had sent Gorod and the wolves out so he could have time for reflection. He heard her greet Gorod and grumble at the feral wolf pack as she came through the outer door. He had raised one of the larger seats onto its feet. The back was shot out of it, so the shredded leather padding looked like ruptured blubber. He had placed it in front of the cobwebbed windows and was sitting, leaning forward, elbows on his knees.
"Do you bring me the day's agenda, ma'am?"
he asked, without looking at her.
"I do not," she replied. "I have dealt with most matters. You need time to think."
"I never stop thinking, ma'am."
"Then you need time to focus, my lord. The hour has come to commit."
He glanced at her, though he still sat forward.
"I have already committed. You know this. Macragge and the 500 worlds, they are the Imperium. Imperium Secundus. The contingency that we never even dreamed might be necessary is now a practical."
She nodded.
"You continue to evade my meaning," she said. "What I mean is, I think it's time you admitted it to more than just me and your closest confidences. It has been your private theoretical. Now you must declare Imperium Secundus formally and publicly. You have to have strength in your conviction, and not shrink from the more unedifying aspects of it. If you do not have faith in it, then neither will a single soul in the 500 worlds."
He opened his mouth to answer, but said nothing.
"What is it? What makes you hesitate?" Uten asked. "Is it a fear that you are usurping every bit as much as Horus? Or is it..."
"Grief," he said quietly. "Grief that my father and Terra and the grand dream of the Imperium are lost, and the only way for our civilization to survive is to consolidate here. It is a burden I never looked for, ma'am, and it is made heavier by sorrow."
He looked out through the crazed glass and surveyed the towers and stacks of Macragge Civitas, golden in the sickly warp light.
"You think I should make a formal declaration because I look weak, don't you?" he asked.
"Yes," she said, nodding.
She adjusted her grip on her staff to ease her stance and rest her back.
"The morale of Ultramar has never been lower. Kalth, the ruin storm, the war against the sons of Lorgar and Angron, these things have battered us. But the assault on you... My lord, it has shown us that even the most precious thing we have left is not safe."
Uten glanced around at the cold devastation of the chamber. Her eyes lingered on the smashed cogitator and a broken bust of Conor.
"Just an hour before this happened," she said, gesturing at the room with her slender left hand, "I lectured you about how vulnerable you are. I am sorry if my tone was hectoring. I am not sorry that my words were true. This is all we have left of the Imperium, and you are the last precious prince. You cannot be all the things you once were. You are too valuable to be risked. You are too important to be diluted with a surfeit of roles."
"This isn't a conversation about declaring Secundus, is it?" he asked.
There is no point declaring Secundus if Secundus has an empty throne. You must declare yourself.
What? He asked, a mocking laugh behind the words. Emperor Gilliman.
Regent, at least, my lord. Don't look at me like that. I know how you hate the word.
He stood up. Newton, I cannot. I cannot command and rule. I cannot administer this empire and be its figurehead.
I told you, you must delegate, she said. No one else can possibly be head of state. No one else can possibly be regent. You are the last Primarch, my lord, the last loyal son, the only loyal son. Become what you must become. Invest yourself as the rallying point of Imperium Secundus. Be imperial and reveal your renewed strength, your resolve, your mettle and the glory like a phoenix rising from these ashes. Leave the everyday mechanics of imperial business to others.
That is my point, he replied. I trust no one else to oversee those mechanics. I have done it for so long, I trust no one else. Not even you, dear lady.
Because I am not capable? She sniffed, though she was mocking.
His reply was typically honest. Because you are old, Lady Yuton. You are human and old. I do not know how much longer life will let you stand at my side. I cannot rely on you being here, and I do not trust anyone else.
A good answer, she said. But you know, I have known you since you were a child, Robute. I know when you are being careful with the truth. This is such a time. For all your logic, none of the things you have said are the real reason you will not declare yourself Imperial Regent.
Is that so? He asked.
You know it is.
He sighed. Then let me say it once. I cannot build an empire and put myself on the throne, even if I am the only candidate. It smacks of hubris, of arrogance, of overweening pride and foul ambition.
It smacks of Horus Lupercal, she said.
Oh, indeed. It will diminish me in the eyes of those who yet respect me, and it will simply confirm the doubts of all those who do not. Look at Gilliman, they will say, taking advantage of this crisis and naming himself king. Look at his unseemly eagerness. Look how fast he jumped in to take unwholesome advantage of the situation.
I am glad to hear you admit your misgivings at last, she said. But it is the only practical action to take. You always taught me that practical trumps theoretical.
But in this matter the theoretical stinks, he said. I have been holding out hope that one other brother might still come to me. Rogel, stars, but I would hand the throne selflessly to him. Sanguinius, in an instant. These are worthy heirs. These are noble brothers.
And if they were willing, it would validate Secundus, she nodded. Their sanction would reinforce your choices.
Any loyal son, murmured Gilliman. Right now, I would take any loyal son.
Even Russ? She asked.
Gilliman laughed. He's a barbarian, he said, but he is still a king, and he is loyal in ways that shame us all. Yes, even Russ. Perhaps we need a truly fierce monarch to see us through this new strife.
And you, as his conscience, would keep his crown clean, she said.
Of course, he said. He sighed deeply again and looked around. Have the residency staff clear this room. Strip it, make it new. I'm hungry. I think I'll feast with the wolves tonight.
He looked at her.
Rest easy, ma'am, he said. By morning I will have made my decision. If I am going to declare as regent, you will know it soon, and we can prepare for the announcement.
There is no one else fit, my lord, said Yuton.
There is no one else at all, he replied. So I suppose it will have to be me. The scorched corpse that had fallen on the southern deem of Magnum Acrag Civitas had been taken to a private secure suite in the lower levels of the residence's Medicaid hall. The exits to the area were guarded and locked, and only authorized personnel were allowed in and out, or even to know the nature of what the lab suite contained. Valentus Dolor, Tetrarch of Occluda, arrived unescorted and strode down the long, echoing hallway to a series of iris valve hatches. Ultramarine's guards bowed to him and let him pass. The hatches scraped as they dilated one by one. Captain Casimir was waiting for him in a stark laboratory chamber of zinc and galvanized steel. The place was lit by greenish lights and smelled industrial. A massive iron casket lay on a raised plinth in the main area of the room. There were heavy armor glass viewing ports built into the sides and top of the casket, so that the body, suspended in embalming solutions, could be examined. Instrument locks in the sides of the casket also allowed for surgical tools to be inserted so that tissue samples could be taken. All that could be seen through the ports was a thin, scummy murk. Several Medicaid technicians were working around the casket.
"Do we have an identity?" Dolor asked his equerry.
"No, Lord," replied Casimir, "but we have answered one question." He offered Dolor the data slate he had been holding. Dolor took it and read. "Careful analysis of orbital watch records has finally revealed how our dead stranger arrived," said Casimir. "You see the brief spike there? A teleport flare in the upper atmosphere. Non-standard teleportation pattern."
"So he materialized in the upper atmosphere out of nowhere?"
"And then fell," Captain Casimir said, "all the way to the surface, burning like a meteor as he cut through the atmosphere."
"Do we know anything about the origin point of the teleportation?"
"The flare pattern is being examined, but I doubt it, my lord." Dolor handed the slate back and took a few steps towards the casket.
"The more we learn, the more of a mystery he becomes.
He stopped short. Some monitor alarms had started to buzz. A few amber telltales lit up along the console beside the plinth. The Medicaid technicians reacted in surprise and backed away for a second.
"What is it?" asked Dolor. "What's happening?"
"I don't know, Lord Tetrarch," said one of the technicians.
"It makes no sense," said another.
"It must be a system malfunction," said a third.
A new alarm started to sound. Dolor stepped closer to the casket, his hand on the hilt of his sword. He peered in at one of the murky portals.
"Someone explain to me what's going on," he snarled.
There was a sudden, very violent bang. Even Dolor jerked back. The sound had been made by an impact from inside the casket. Something had struck one of the glass portals very hard. Dolor looked. He blinked, pressed against the inside of the armor glass. Bloody, raw and peeling with blackened, burned meat were the palm and fingertips of a large human hand.
"Open the damn casket," Dolor ordered, drawing his sword. "In the name of the 500 worlds, whatever's in there isn't dead at all."
The ship came out of the darkness, and within its darkness an endless hunt paused for a moment, for the first moment in 16 weeks. Deep in the almost lightless void of the ship's reactor's vast heat sink, the quarry paused, a nocturnal ghost, condemned to be absolutely alone for the rest of his life. He crouched on a rusting stanchion above the smoking furnaces of the ship's engines and wrapped his arms around his body. His cloak was tattered and black. What little light was coming off the smouldering embers of the drive chambers beneath him caught along the razored lines of his claws. He felt the bump, the ripple, the heave of transition. He heard the arrhythmic flutter of the engines as they dimensionally corrected. He felt his guts twist and his sinuses pinch. It made him whimper. The ship had made a translation into real space. The quarry tilted his head back and began to laugh. He peeled back cracked lips to expose teeth that, had there been any light, would have showed as blackened and rotting. His laughter, as sharp and shattered as a carving glacier, fell away and echoed down the sink. The rules had just been rewritten. In real space, the ship was no longer a finite prison. He was no longer the quarry. The rules had just changed, and people were going to die. A lot of them. All of them. At long last. The ship came out of the darkness.
"Translation complete," Captain Stenius called from the high rail platform of the bridge. "Real space positioning achieved."
Below him on the main four-station deck, the bridge crew plugged into their various consoles, chattered back and forth, sharing and updating the surge of real space data as fast as their automatics would allow. Stenius turned to look at the ship's lord. The low light of the flagship's bridge hazed off Stenius's smoked silver augmetic eyes. The captain's face, immobilized by nerve damage, hadn't registered an expression for decades. The ship's lord, the huntsman, knew, however, that there was a smile of relief locked away in that unmoving flesh. He sat on his titanic engraved throne, a shadow at the back of the flagship's vast bridge space, a monarch with no realm. He raised his head, acknowledging Stenius, and looked at the main display. The light was astonishing. A beacon of some sort, a world thoroughly illuminated. His ship, miraculously, with all of its fleet in sequence behind it, was ploughing into a stellar system lit up by the greatest intergalactic lighthouse that he had ever seen. The system was armed and defended. Already challenges were coming in on all channels. He could read star forts heating up weapon banks on the strategium display, interplanetary bands of defence, mine belts, gun stations powering batteries, and interceptor fleets turning hard in response to the pulse of their abrupt arrival. Of course they would. Of course they would react so urgently. What the huntsman was bringing with him was one of the greatest war fleets in the Imperium, perhaps the greatest.
"This isn't the Terran solar system," he said.
"Not even slightly, my lord," replied Stenius. "It's not even the solar segmentum."
"Answer me now. Where is this?" asked the huntsman. His voice was barely audible.
Lady Therilyn Fyana of House Naosine, the flagship's navigator, stepped off the elevator platform from the navigation pit and approached the huntsman's throne. The Nephila had much damaged her. Her withered form was supported on either side by her brothers, Ardil Aeneas and Ceophan.
"You are correct, lord," she said in the whisper that was all she could manage. "This is not Terra, and this is not the light of the Astronomicon. I cannot yet account for the presence or nature of the beacon, but it has drawn us out of the storm. It has done it in ways that..."
"What do you say to me, lady?" asked the huntsman. Fiana shook her head.
"I cannot explain, my lord," she whispered. "There is something at work here, some technology I cannot explain. Not psychic, empathic. It is as though the light showed itself to us because it knew what we wanted. It knew where we wanted to be."
"Expand on this," the huntsman said.
"Despite the storm, my lord," the navigator whispered, "despite the turmoil of the warp, we have arrived precisely where it wanted us to be. This is Macragge. This is the heart system of Ultramar."
The huntsman rose. He stared at the planet ahead of them.
"By my father's dead gods," he breathed.
"Orders, my lord,"
asked Captain Stenius. "We are bombarded with challenges. Vox, picked feed, psychic and sub-vox. We have been target-locked by 16 of the star forts and platform systems, and 2 of the 3 nearest intercept fleets are moving in to acquire firing solutions. They will start shooting very soon."
He shrugged. "Of course, my lord," Stenius added in a more hushed tone. "Our shields are raised. We can cut right through them. We can burn and splinter, Macragge, if you so wish. An order is all I require."
The huntsman held out his left hand.
"Vox," he said.
Servitors, gilded and cherubic, flew a Master Vox horn into his grasp and braced it for him.
"To my brother, Lord Gilliman," the huntsman said, "on all channels, I bid you welcome from afar. I wish to alight at Macragge and parley with you. It is I, Rabute. It is the lion. Respond."